Good morning. On Highway 101 today, a native-born Californian who spent much of his life outside of America and some of it in harm's way. Bob Baer was born in 1953 and made the journey from being a ski bum to spending two decades working as a covert operative with the US Central Intelligence Agency. He's been stationed in places like India, Lebanon, North Iraq and Tajikistan. His memoir, See No Evil, The True Story of a Ground Soldier in the CIA's War on Terrorism, deals with his increasing disillusionment and his ultimate departure 5 years before the events of September 11th, 2001. Baer's book became the loose basis for the award-winning film Syriana, in which a CIA agent called Bob Barnes was played by George Clooney. Bob Baer, you're very welcome.
It's great to be here.
We'll come back to George Clooney a little bit later. At the age of, I think it was around 9 or 10, you were brought on an unexpected grand tour of Europe. What happened?
My mother was teaching at UCLA political science and got fed up, very liberal. Little red schoolhouse they used to call UCLA back in those days. And she just got up and we left one day for a plane for Zurich. And I dropped out of school for 2-3 years at the age of 10. Didn't go to school. We drove to Moscow. We drove all across Europe. We made Berlin for the the Cuban Missile Crisis. And they had, the Russians had surrounded Berlin then, October 62. So it was quite education. And she was a bit of a historian and decided that she was going to homeschool me in the passenger seat of a car as we drove around Europe.
Was it a great experience? I mean, at the age of 9 or 10, can you actually appreciate what is going on? I'm sure it actually seems quite normal.
Depends who you are, I suppose. I suppose some kids could absorb, but it was fairly lonely. It was, you know, you don't have any friends, and you're living in hotels constantly. And the way we lived, we would run out of money at the end of the month. So we would go from a first-class hotel to some pension someplace that was just sort of, you know, without toilets or anything like that. So it was a varied life.
And your grandfather, I think, was providing the funding.
My grandfather was funding my mother's a trust fund baby.
How did a mother who was as liberal as your mother send you to a military school?
My uncle was on the board of directors. I wouldn't have gotten it. I had straight F's from Aspen High School.
So she decided, liberalism or not, she was still going to send
you
somewhere.
To be educated. I was going to go to college, I was going to finish high school, I was going to be educated, and then I could drop off the face of the earth.
And was it very literally regimented at this school?
When you walked in the dormitories, you had to walk square corners. You drop a quarter on a bed, and it had to bounce. That's how, and they would have white glove inspections where they'd come with a white glove, is just like it sounds, and run it across the top of the armoire, the closet. It was such abrupt change. What was so interesting, going from Aspen, wide open, to military school in the Midwest.
Interesting is not necessarily a word I would use.
I enjoyed it after a while because it gave you, you knew what the rules were. And you know, there was no question that you were going to be up at 6:33 in the morning out of your bed, or the seniors would come by and flip your bed with you in it. And for a kid that age, when you know the rules, well, I'm getting a little bit old and conservative now. It seemed easier.
And was there much hazing, much bullying?
Not particularly. Not a little bit. I mean, if somebody was particularly odd, they got bullied and they probably got forced out. Just, you know, the social oppression of a military school.
And did you behave yourself when you were there or did you rebel?
Oh, absolutely not. Completely rebelled. You know, at one point we took the pool balls and stuck them in the Reveille cannon with a piece of cardboard. So they didn't go all the way to the bottom. And the kid that morning that put the shell in to you know, for Reveille, shot the pool balls across the river and went a couple windows across the houses. And there's kids, you know, pranks, that's what it was about.
Now, you went to Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Tell me about some of your antics there, because that was not military school.
It was not military school. And, you know, I think boys mature much later age than girls, I think. That's what I figured out in life so far. And I remember one time riding a motorcycle through the library, Pierce Reading Room, and halfway through the library room, I used to be a motorcycle racer, and I pulled a wheelie and across
in a library,
inside the library, across the carpet, skidded around, and came out of the library. And the funny part was that the guy in the library trying to study for final exams, it was 1973, was George Tenet, who became my boss,
head of the CIA.
And I met him at the White House. He was director for national security affairs, for intelligence, for some very grandiose title. And One thing about, people forget you, and I like being forgotten, and he didn't. He pulled me away from a meeting, says, I'll never forget you. It goes back to that incident at Georgetown.
Were you disciplined at all when you were in Georgetown, or did you get away with it?
I got away with it. That's the whole point. That's what the CIA is about. You get away with it. You actually graduated.
The picture, I suppose, I've been trying to create from your recollections of childhood and adolescence is of somebody who shouldn't even be thinking about getting into the CIA. How did you, in fact, get in?
I was right here in San Francisco. I had finished Georgetown, decided to move to San Francisco, had a friend here from high school, from Culver. He let me stay on his couch, and I was not moving toward a job. And one day, we were sitting down at breakfast, and he said, you got to get a job. He was working at Bank of America. He said, well, you're not qualified to work there. And, it was one of these conversations. And at the time, the CIA was in the press. You had the Pike Church Committee hearings. They were in all sorts of trouble. And he knew about the trouble I liked to get into. And so he said, why don't you apply to the CIA? He leaves for work. I call up the Federal Center here, and they give me an address in Lawndale, California, which is some insipid suburb of Los Angeles. Call them up. Send me an application. It's all very matter-of-fact. And this thing arrives, and it's about a week later, and it's like 50 pages long. Every organization you belong to, every organization your aunts or uncles have belonged to, and on and on and on. There's a psychological exam, and the one question I remember was, have you ever wet your – do you wet your bed or something like that? It was just very bizarre. Anyhow, the process went on, and knowing my background, and I had fairly good grades – not good grades, but they were fair, middling. I said, I'll never get in. Security problems, Aspen, Colorado, LSD, and the whole thing. I went through that whole area.
Not to mention motorcycling through libraries.
Motorcycling through the library and on and on. And at the time, when the application got underway, I was living in Berkeley with two anarchists. I think, all right, I'm never going to get in. So it was a joke. It was another prank. And when they finally called me up, this was after a polygraph going to Washington, on and on and on. You can imagine what the process is for 6 months. And they said, can you come 2 weeks to Washington to start the training course. I said, come next week if you want. Didn't own anything.
So there you were. And tell me a little bit about training on the legendary farm.
The farm is located in Virginia, and that's all I can say. Don't ask me why. Everybody knows where it is. But you are put in, it's what we call a boot camp in this country. And the idea is put as much pressure on you as possible to see how you can react. They want to break you down. Interrogation, training, taking care of classified material, which is, papers or codes or things like that. I mean, if you just leave them out, there was retribution of all sorts. You could be put on leave. You could be fired eventually, even in training. And then you had another, was it 4 or 5 months of military training? It's jumping out of airplanes, combat jumps in the middle of the night, going to Arizona, desert training, eating rattlesnakes, and on and on. And it's not so much to train you in these things. I mean, they give you a Dragunov assassin's rifle, and you know how to fire it, and all sorts of machine guns and Kalashnikovs and on and on. I think it was more to see what your character's about.
What was the worst part?
I think the worst part was Florida, 10,000 islands. It was the most miserable experience of my life. And I've had a lot of bad things I've gone through. You live in a swamp for 10 days, and you're walking with water up to your shoulders with moccasin snakes, which I don't think there are in Europe, but one bites you, and you are out of it if you don't die for 6 months. And to the point where the temperature is 120, and your skin turns green, but it's like tanned green. It does not come off with washing. And you sleep in hammocks at night, and you're going through this. And then when it got really bad, they move you out into the mangrove swamps where you're eaten by sand gnats all night. There's chew on you, can't sleep. And then once you're really tired, then they make you go out and find a weapons cache that's dug in these islands to see, at that point, can you still follow a compass course? And a lot of people break down and just leave.
And presumably you were trained how to kill if necessary.
The garrotes and things like that. And there was training on countering torture, a lot of that.
Have you ever had to use any of those skills?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, the CIA avoided torture. I don't know what happened during Vietnam, but afterwards, the CIA avoided torture at all costs. I mean, you know, when I was in Lebanon, the Lebanese were torturing people to death, and we were just completely cut off any connection with Lebanese at that point. All this Guantanamo and the rest of it came after I left the CIA. They never taught us to torture. We were given all sorts of executive orders saying you will not in any way participate in torture or assist or take intelligence derived from torture.
Okay, you are now an operative. What are you supposed to do once you get out in the field?
What you do is you go out and you recruit people because the CIA collects human intelligence. You go out and you find somebody who knows secrets you want to know, and you get them to compromise their national security or their principles or however you want to put it. When I joined, it was going after Soviets, a Soviet military officer, a Soviet tank commander who was assigned to a unit that would cross the Fulda Gap if there was a war. Anybody in the missile forces of the Soviet Union. That's what the United States needed to know was, are they going to fire the missiles at us? We went after these people in embassies, you know, the military attaché in, I don't know, Prague or London. I mean, he was a prime target. You found a way to run into him, and I mean literally run into him. We used to see Soviets, we'd pick out and we'd ram their cars, and then you'd jump out with a fistful of $100 bills and, oh, I'm sorry, I'm an idiot, but don't tell my, you know, we can't talk about this. I'll be in a lot of trouble. You know, just here's some money and give the guy $10,000. I mean, at that point in his mind, is he compromising himself? He would be compromising himself under the Soviet system, and you start. And that's a bit blunt, but you listen to telephones at the Soviet embassy and you find a guy who's having money problems. You know, he's talking to his wife and saying, you spent too much money on, and say, all right, this guy, we want this guy. We want to find some way to compromise him. And it worked. I mean, you look at the Ames case, the super spy.
Rick Ames.
Yeah,
he was a CIA man who basically spied on
– gave the identities of Russian spies working for the CIA, gave them to the Russians in Washington. And the fact is that a lot of people miss is that we did have 12 very well-placed agents that he compromised. There were many more that he didn't compromise because he didn't know about them.
And he did that for money.
Did it for money. He was crazy. He was – That's the interesting thing about Ames, and this is the beginning of the end of the CIA, is that he came in as clerical help, and then he worked himself into, and wasn't completely vetted. And the fact that they let him get away with having this wife who was known Soviet connections, he broke all sorts of rules.
How did you bag? How did you recruit? Tell me how you recruited agents or how you recruited your first agent or the most interesting agent you recruited.
Well, the first time I started was the Libyan, and I think that was the most nerve-wracking experience of my life because I was young. I was about 24, and I sat down this Libyan, and I essentially said, hey, how would you like to spy for the United States
government? Where was this?
It was in India. Military officer, and he just blew up. I mean, I had not done my homework. I didn't know what I was doing. It goes back to they probably shouldn't let me in the CIA, but I did not have the maturity to ask somebody to compromise himself on national security. Now, that changed over the course of 20 years. I mean, 20 years later, I actually pitched. The head of the FSB, the Russian Internal Service. It was a joke, but it's an interesting arc because I didn't feel at all nervous and I didn't have any permission. Then I went up to this guy. We're at a party, an intelligence party in Kazakhstan, and I said, you know, General Lebed, if you remember General Lebed? I was joking, of course. He's a CIA agent, and so is General Powell. General Powell's going to be president. This is the early 90s. And I said, this is the time to sign up with the CIA. We're on the top of the world. And he said, oh, Mr. Bob, you're so funny. And that was the end of it. But, you know, I wouldn't have considered doing that when I was 24 years old, and then to the point where you really do in the CIA every day of your life telling lies and living a cover and asking people to compromise themselves, you get better and better and better at it. So by the time I'm 45, I know what I'm doing.
What was your most significant achievement in that area?
I recruited a Hezbollah guy, and that was a very important recruitment. At the time, they had the hostages. And we were looking at various terrorism attacks. By the way, the CIA has let me write about this in my book, See No Evil.
Okay, you've recruited somebody. How do you communicate with them?
That's when you go into clandestine communication. It depends where you are. If you're in London, it doesn't really matter. because you're an American in London. The British don't look at you in any particular – you know, they're not trying to catch you doing something, or even Ireland. But if you're in the Soviet Union, you immediately have to go into indirect communication, burst transmissions. I mean, you know, like a cell phone, you can drive by an embassy and push a button and it will send a transmission that's compressed and will send that message into the embassy, like the American – your agent will do that. Or you can do – I use a lot of satellite communications, the early ones, and of course before cell phones, so they actually had to fit in a briefcase. They were encrypted. They'd shoot at a satellite at a certain time. You had to give schedules. It was very complicated, especially in the third world, to give this training to, you know, because you know you had like a 2-minute window to send a transmission. Secret writing was great. You had microdots. You know, I actually know how to plan a microdot. It's sort of a diminishing asset knowing how to plan a microdot. But it's, you know, we used to do that.
Explain the microdot to me.
A microdot is a reduced negative. It's reduced to the size of a period.
So you say photograph a letter, for example.
You photograph a letter.
Reduce
it becomes a negative.
Right down to the size of a full stop.
To a full stop. And then you will take in a period and you'll cut with a curved razor blade a period in a piece of paper. And this is before, you know, we were using typewriters. You stick it under the period in the papers if you know how to cut it right. And it takes a lot of practice. The microdot will go under there, insert it in the page, and then you reseal it. It's almost impossible to find unless you know it's there.
And what about dead letter drops? Is that a fiction?
No. We used them all the time. One of my favorite things, I mean, I would make a fantastic drug dealer using the tradecraft I know, is let's say you have to give an agent, this is like a Soviet working for you, money, and you're outside Moscow. You seek a part of the road that has a dip in it. It goes up, it dips down, and then back up. You know who's behind you. You can see in your rearview mirror. So you come over the top and you go down to the dip where your car is momentarily out of sight, traffic in front and back of you. It's going to be in front and back. And you have a lever on your car that will drop a piece of tailpipe off the car. It will hit the road and slide off. No one can see it except the agent who's waiting in the bushes. And he sees this piece of the car come off and he knows that's his money.
How much of this kind of stuff goes on in Ireland?
Not much. Ireland was never a strategic target for the United States.
But there are Soviet diplomats in Ireland. There were.
And the Irish looked the other way. Remember in Iran-Contra, they had Irish passports. And I think our chief of station in Tehran had an Irish passport. I mean, that was sort of the only – I mean, the Irish were very cooperative. They were on our side in the Cold War. And if there was a particular Russian – no, the Irish didn't care about the Russians one way or another, but they would give them to us.
Who would be cooperating with you, the special branch?
I think it was the special branch. I've never worked with the Irish before, so I don't know.
But you never had any problems? The CIA never had any problems doing anything they wanted to do in Ireland?
As long as they didn't break the law. I mean, you know, you couldn't do crazy stuff there. But if it was just between – it was spy versus spy, that was fine. But Ireland, while I was in the CIA, was never a target. Since then, I know that Ireland has become a center for commercial spying, which is very interesting.
Tell me a bit about that.
Well, let's say I want to know about you, and the first thing I want is your cell phone records, because I've got your phone number and I've got your landline. So from your landline, I can do a data search and get your cell phone in Ireland very easily. But I want to know everybody you've talked to in the last 6 months. Well, there's a service in Dublin that I can go to and buy that. It's called an international registry. Every time you make a phone call, it's registered. It's sort of like Berlin was during the Cold War, Dublin, because you've got Russians coming through. You've got – and the police there sort of turn a blind eye. I mean, this is post-CIA stuff that I know about because ex-colleagues work there.
So this is kind of security stuff, or this is industrial espionage?
This is the real espionage now.
Yeah.
When the big corporations do it, or let's say a big corporation is having a problem with the Red Mafia, they might go to Ireland to some security companies there to help look into them. Don't ask me how it ended up in Dublin. I just know it does. That's where people go for answers.
And that is going on?
As we speak.
On a widespread scale?
And Northern Ireland as well. You can get a lot of telephone databases in Northern Ireland. Don't ask me why. I don't know if the British are just...
So you can check out people, not just in Ireland, but you can check out people
worldwide
by using sources within Ireland.
Your Berkeley number right now, which I have, I can get all your telephone records within 30 minutes from now, leaving this.
And you can get that by using a resource in Ireland.
Yes. It's foreign. It costs a lot of money. Not that I would do it. I don't really care. I don't do industrial espionage or consulting or anything like that. So I just know it exists.
But this is not something that the CIA are doing necessarily.
No, the federal government can't do it. You need a warrant. Yeah. I mean, I can get into Sprint for – you know what Sprint is, the telephone company.
Indeed.
You have a prepaid phone card that you're using. I can get into Sprint and I can find out every call you've made, even though it has to be hand-searched. There is a huge market in this country for data mining, and it's illegal for the FBI or the CIA to get into it. But as private citizens, we can do it.
This is CIA, ex-CIA.
Ex-CIA people.
Quote-unquote consultants.
Consultants. This is the, like, you know, I was earlier talking about, you know, cashing out, pillaging Washington. This is what a lot of people are doing. They've gone private. As the CIA has emptied its, you know, offices, everybody's gone private.
You were one of the first, if not the first, CIA operative to know that kidnappings of U.S. officials were going to take place in Lebanon. How did that happen?
There was a no man's land called the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, which is between Syria and the coast in Lebanon. And we vaguely knew that the Iranians were setting up an organization. This is in 82 and 83, which became Hezbollah in 1985. And I was fascinated by the Shia. I spoke Arabic. I was assigned to Damascus at the time, and I spent a lot of time in the Bekaa Valley. And I got to know people. I got to know families. I got to know the Musawi clan, a big clan in the Bekaa Valley. And in a situation like this, in a war situation, when there's all this hostility, you elicit information, and you make personal connections, and you make inferences, which substitutes for good intelligence. Anyhow, one day I went over and said, I'm going up to Baalbek next week. Any problems up there? And one of my friends on the border said, no, they're going to kidnap an American. You don't want to go. I don't know. Is this intelligence? You know, a classical intelligence officer, no, it's not intelligence. But anyhow, it was warning enough for me not to go. I tried to disseminate the information inside the CIA, and the chief of station in Damascus said, forget it. This isn't intelligence. And then the political counselor, April Glaspie, who later became ambassador to Iraq during the first invasion, put it in the consular brief. And so there is a record that I did know about this. And this was in April, March 84, and Bill Buckley was kidnapped.
He was the CIA station chief.
CIA station chief was kidnapped a couple weeks later, a week later, I can't remember.
And you went to Baalbek. Unbeknownst to your own station.
Because I understood the politics. Until this day, people do not look at context when they look at politics. I went up to Baalbek with the advisor to Hafez al-Assad, the president of Syria. I knew the Iranians wouldn't touch this guy, and I knew Hezbollah wouldn't touch him because I understood the context.
Did he know who you were?
Yeah, he knew I was an American official. I don't know if he knew I was CIA or not. But the point was, I had made friends with this guy, knew him, helped him with visas and so on and so on. And the context of the politics in the Bekaa Valley made me immune because I was with the Syrians because they had to be out of their minds to go after the advisor to Assad. And Washington, this is the problem, does not get that context in the Middle East. That's what they're missing. Not the intelligence, the context. And the reason I have the context is because I live there with the people. You know, eat food, you know, talk with them, joke with them, know their families, things like that, which really does make a difference.
And without being aware of it, I think on that trip that you're talking about, you stood close to where a number of Western hostages were being kept, including Bill Buckley.
I actually looked. It was the officers' quarters, married officers' quarters, where the hostages were being held. Now, I didn't know that at the time. I was right outside the gate at the Sheikh Abdallah Barracks. Later, I got to debrief Father Jenko, who had been held with Bill Buckley, been held in the room next to his, tied to a radiator. He described looking out and actually seeing where I had been standing in the ruins of Baalbek. This is piecing things together. And this, to understand intelligence, is what you have to do is spend years and years and years and remember these things.
Did you have any nasty moments on any of those trips? Were there times when you thought you were in danger, or did you always go in with somebody whom you knew was invulnerable?
random violence, normally. I'm not a particular hero. I do not go stand in the line of, you know, a machine gun or anything like that. I usually know where I'm going and why it's safe or why it's not. I won't go to Iraq today, for instance. Friends of mine still do, Americans. I just won't go. I'm going to Afghanistan this summer, but that's in a Centurion tank.
There were times in Beirut when you were offered the opportunity to have men killed whom you knew to be Islamic terrorists. Why did you choose not to take up those offers?
Because I come from a liberal middle-class family, and I just, you know, yes, I could have gone out, and yes, I could have paid for, out of CIA money, and there was no accounting, to put car bombs next to terrorists and kill them.
But it would have been Bob Baer who was doing this, not the CIA.
It would have been Bob Baer, absolutely. I had no authority, and I could have been wrong about the intelligence. Didn't do it. I mean, I never considered doing it. I was given the opportunity. You're always given the opportunity as an intelligence operative to do serious harm.
Given what has happened in the last 6 years, do you now regret not having ordered those assassinations?
Absolutely not. I've completely gone back. You know, I'm a hopeless liberal at this point. I just, you know, Guantanamo, I was in the Dan Rather program when they broke Guantanamo. And Abu Ghraib. I was part of that. I just totally oppose it. It doesn't do you any good. The intelligence is no good from it. You just harm the United States, get involved in torture, assassination.
So you don't think very much of what the CIA is up to at the moment?
No, I think people should go to jail, frankly.
People in the CIA should go to jail?
Absolutely, whoever ordered this, including George Tenet.
Changes in the CIA. What began to happen in the agency and the operation of the agency in the 1980s, even before the end of the Cold War? You describe a kind of a drift.
I think a couple things were happening. One is Washington. There's a certain decline setting in the politics of Washington. It's actually gotten worse over the years. That was reflected in the CIA. You also had a phenomenon of very talented people coming in, spending 4 or 5 years in the CIA and saying, all right, now it's time to get out. I want to go work in Wall Street. I want to be a lawyer. I want to go do marine biology or whatever. And they got out. You have in a bureaucracy that's becoming more and more mediocre. And beyond mediocre, and into the point of almost incompetence, which drives out more people, the competent. By the 90s, of course, you had people not even considering going in, and you had the Clinton administration says, what do we need intelligence for? We would have discussions about whether we should switch from the Soviet Union to investigating abuses of the environment. We were going to add that to our operating directive. We didn't know what we were doing. You know, we had the Ames compromise in 94, that drove out hundreds more people. So you saw gradually the CIA becoming less and less effective. And the mission became less important because the Soviet Union went away. What was the CIA there for? What, you know, spy on Airbus? You know, let Boeing spy on Airbus. That's not the CIA's mission. You know, eventually I got to the point where I could read the New York Times or the Washington Post and get better information than I could reading CIA briefings. And one of the biggest problems in the Middle East, let me be totally politically incorrect, was wives. And it usually is wives because only male case officers can work in the Middle East because of the culture. It's so male-dominated. So you have a young man who takes his wife to Sana'a, Yemen, and he says, hey, dear, you've got to spend the next 3 years home watching DVDs. You can't go out. You can't walk on the street. You're in an apartment. We'll send a car around to pick you up, and you can go to a tea at, you know, whatever big hotel, and then take you home.
With the other wives.
With the other wives. Now, if people, you hope that people, you know, a lot of people marry educated people. You just can't tell a female lawyer, you know, with a practice, we're going to Yemen, and you're going to watch DVDs for 3 years. So these guys that were staying in would say, all right, I want out of Yemen. I want to go to Europe. I want to go to London. My wife can work, whatever. So you had language ability going away. You had cultural understanding, you know, that Ivy League elite.
Who spoke Arabic and who had experience in the Middle East.
Yeah.
But didn't want to go there anymore.
Yeah. I talked to George Cave a lot. He's a famous CIA case officer that went to Iran-Contra, went to Tehran, speaks absolutely native Persian. He can sit down and he will recite. He was memorized Hafiz. It's incomprehensible. I speak some Farsi to me, but he has memorized and he speaks fluent Arabic. He was an oil worker in Saudi Arabia in the 50s, joined the CIA. People like that are gone. And they miss the context of the Middle East. So you see a CIA where you have the white Russians used to come in. They're all gone. They went away, and there are people that speak rudimentary Russian now.
So that, in a sense, explains the CIA's lack of preparedness for what happened on the 11th of September 2001.
Oh, yeah, that and computers. Here's the point of 9/11. You had two terrorists that were in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, meeting with somebody who was wanted and indicted in the United States for trying to fly airplanes into buildings or planning to. You know, they separate and they go to San Diego. And the CIA does not tell the FBI. That's the crux of 9/11. There is no computer system. Remember, this is the country with Silicon Valley. Who knows computers better than people in this country? Why the FBI and the CIA can't communicate until this day? What is it, 6 years now after 9/11?
They're still deadly rivals, are they?
They're not only deadly rivals, they just don't talk. The FBI catches bank robbers and the CIA robs banks. That's a bit of a cliche, but that's fairly true.
Tell me about the planned coup attempt against Saddam Hussein in March 1995 and your part in it.
It seemed like a good idea at the time. I was chief of station in Iraq, assigned to a place called Salah ad-Din, and I'd just come in country when a Sunni general came to me and said, Saddam's got to go, and I got a plan. No one in Washington wanted to hear it. The plan started with an assassination. Saddam had a girlfriend near Tikrit in a small town called Samarra, and he often went to visit her there, and the plan was, when he was on his way up, to ambush him at a bridge, which I've seen this bridge, and it really did exist. Cut off both ends of the convoy, shoot it up till no one moved. I send this into Washington. It was like dead silence. It's funny being on the end of I had real communications in Washington, encrypted communications. And so at that point, I have to think on my feet. Of course, a lot of my friends and say, well, that's where the problem started. The bear had to think on his feet. So I go back to the guy and say, well, we can do a military coup, and that means you give the guy a chance to surrender. And so this guy, being a Sunni general, put together 12 tanks that were in the Salah ad-Din. This isn't the same Salah ad-Din, but the military academy. They weren't supposed to have shells. We arranged to steal shells for them. And once Saddam was in Auja, the village he was born in, he had a very nice house there right on the river, we were going to go in there and surround it and give him a chance to give up. And then if he didn't, then flatten the house. Again, I'm getting no response from Washington. And we know the cables are arriving. And I don't know whether they're going to the White House or not. And stories vary whether they went to the White House or not. Anyhow, I said, to the guy finally, I said, listen, I can't give you any money. I can't give you air support. I can't give you anything. It's your country. Go ahead. As far as I'm concerned. But you're hearing that from Bob Baer. I'm not the president of the United States. I just know we can't ever live with Saddam. That's our policy. I told the Kurds the same thing. Go for it if you want. Preparations get underway. You can see troops moving all over northern Iraq. Saddam goes on, gets wind of this. And he was supposed to get wind of the preparations, not the 12 tanks, but the rest of the coup. Everybody starts moving, and then we get a letter from Tony Lake, the national security advisor, saying, this thing's been compromised. It was a nonsensical message. One of the Kurdish groups that was supposed to occupy Mosul backs out. At the same time, they arrested the couriers that were going to go to the tank company, tell them to go ahead and move. It fell apart. One of the Kurdish groups continued to attack the Iraqi army. We overran over the course of 7 days, 5 Corps, which is near Kirkuk. And that was the end. And then I come back to Washington, and have you ever had your office yellow taped? Crime scene?
No.
I've been badged by the FBI saying we're investigating you for the murder of 2,000 Iraqi soldiers. And oh, by the way, it's a capital crime. And oh, by the way, you can't have a lawyer. I guess it's growing up.
So what happened to you? First of all, what happened to the Iraqi generals?
The Iraqi generals were caught. A lot of them went to jail, put in acid baths. It was the whole idea, what we understood in the CIA is that we wanted to leave the system in Iraq in place. Sunni minority, 20% of the population remains in place, controls the army, the intelligence services. We get rid of Saddam and his cretin sons. And that was the idea. That was our plan. It failed. What can I say? You know, I don't know if it would have worked out, if it would have worked. I mean, it could have been compromised at some other place I didn't know about. I didn't have particularly good control over it. But we did see indications that people were moving. They were moving in Basra, and people were getting ready. And then the White House pulled the rug.
You know, we've already got across the idea that what was going on in the Middle East was murky to an extraordinary degree. Syriana is a very, very murky film. It's about the oil business. What did you think of the film? Because it's very, 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 very loosely based on your book.
Well, it's more based on a trip I took with the director, Stephen Gagan. We left the United States and we went to southern France, and I took him on the jihad/oil tour. And so all those stories in Syriana are in one way or another true. There was a prince I know who did know about 9/11, who came to me and who was kidnapped and drugged and is brain dead now. There was an offer from a Washington law firm to get rid of this prince. And even the story about the young boy dying in the pool is true. There's a Syrian named Wafiq Saeed who was at a party in southern France with a Saudi prince. And the pool closed, the cover closed, and crushed him and killed him. The prince turned around and gave Wafiq Saeed the Yamama deal, which is very famous in Britain.
You know, what is that deal?
The tornadoes for oil, the Thatcher deal. Trillions and trillions of dollars have been made off of this deal. Well, not trillions, but I mean a lot of money.
So
he made $2 billion out of his son dying. So it's that compromise that the film deals with, and the chances of compromise that Clooney's faced with. I mean, Clooney is at the end of his career, dysfunctional family. He's going nowhere. He's, you know, what can he do? Retire and you know, be a bank manager. What's he going to do? He can't even be a bank manager. And then he's offered with a compromise of killing these people, and he turns it down.
Now, when you heard that George Clooney was going to play, and it was going to be, he was going to be called Bob Baer, not Bob Barnes originally.
The studio changed it.
I mean, I know if I was told that George Clooney was playing me, I would be absolutely and utterly delighted. But then he puts on 35 pounds. What was that all about? How did you feel about that?
I didn't care, you know. But when they first called me up, they told me that Rosie O'Donnell was going to play me. You know who that is. I think the Clooney character they wanted, they could not have a James Bond character that had any alternatives in life. He could not have said, oh, I'm going to quit this and
become a male model.
A male model, yeah. Mm-hmm. They needed somebody burnt out. Because it's the offer of compromise to somebody burnt out is more interesting for the writer.
Does it feel good not having, in the main, not having to look over your shoulder as much as you did during the 20 years with the agency, having a rather more relaxed life now in your 50s?
I never took it seriously, the threats. I feel like sometimes I'm the Forrest Gump of the CIA, where you're in a situation where you're getting shelled or shot at, and rather than my heartbeat going up, it goes down, and I don't know why. It seems very remote to me when the world turns violent.
And have you been able to put together, you seem to have been able to put together a decent family life despite your career?
No, it's a failed family life. I was married before, I'm divorced, and it was failed. I mean, it failed because I was always gone when I was in Tajikistan. You cannot live away from your children and expect to bond with them. And
is that what happened to you?
Yeah, failed completely.
With wife and children?
Wife and children. No, now, I'm on a second marriage, which is completely different. I mean, I had no idea what marriage was. Because in the CIA, you're always given the opportunity of escape. You're out late at night. You're on assignments where the family can't go. And as the marriage gets worse, they give you one more escape after another until it just you come home and you don't even know who these people are.
But you have managed, subsequent to leaving the last 10 years, you have managed to create what you know, what someone like me would consider to be a normal life.
Absolutely, totally normal. I mean, I garden, I paint the house.
You have dogs?
Have dogs. I have three dogs, two cats. We're adopting two Chechen children probably this fall. Completely open, tell people where I work, do media, learning, teach myself to write fiction, whatever, and take jobs. It's a lot easier.
Choose a final piece of music for us.
Nico Case, The Tigers Have Spoken. It's Toronto indie music scene. I'd completely lost touch with popular culture, American culture in particular. It was Canadian, but it's big in the United States. And, you know, coming back to the United States and actually living here and talking to people and getting, you know, you reconnect.